That is the key to this whole thing. And the level, I'm going to say this again, the level that you accept the information that I just gave you will mark the urgency with which you will work the rest of the 11 steps. Very, very important that we get that food is just not the problem. It is the solution to the problem. And there's an alternative solution, and it's hanging on the wall of your meetings, or it's in your book on page 58. You've got the steps, and we have to work them. And if we're not working with a sponsor, you need to, in my opinion, for me, I need to work with a sponsor that works with me out of the big book of AA. And when they start distracting me with other things, I know that this is not the person for me. Maybe that works for you. I'm not being critical there. Whatever works for you, God bless you. But for me, I have to work a pure message, an uncut message, and that is the message in the big book of AA. And that's the only message that I have here. Let's continue and let's finish the doctor's opinion so we can start on Bill's story. On the other hand, as strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, page XXIX29, once a psychic change, spiritual awakening has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. And what are the rules? They are the steps. The steps. There's 12 of them. Men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal, "Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me." Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it is not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change, spiritual awakening. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. Now, this flies in the face of everything I've been told from the day I was born. If, young man, if you cared about your mother, you wouldn't eat that way. If you cared about your dad, you wouldn't eat that way. I cared about my mom and dad. I ate that way because I didn't know how not to eat that way. I didn't know how not to eat that way. Here's something none of them ever told me, and some of them hit me, and some of them pushed me, and I've had people come up to me in restaurants and slap my stomach, and I've had people come up to me in restaurants and take the food off my table and give it to the busboy and say, "He doesn't need this," and I didn't even know them. I've had people laughing at me in public places. I've had children laughing at me in public places. I've had adults laughing at me in public places. I have been a spectacle. I have been the butt of jokes. I have been made fun of. I've had people yell things at me from cars. I've had people hit me. I've had people slap me. I've had people threaten me physically because of the weight that I carried. I have experienced all of those things. All of those things. But here's something nobody ever helped me with. How do I not eat Hershey bars? What do I do to not eat M&Ms? How do you do that? How do you not eat peanut M&Ms? I don't know what the other ones are for. These are obviously not for Jewish people, these other ones. If you're going to eat M&Ms, eat the ones with the damn peanuts in it already. What's good? These are obviously not Jewish people. Okay. All right. I don't know what the purpose of those M&Ms are, those other ones. Okay. I'm out of town. I'm sleeping in a hotel. I'm all finished here. Okay. I've had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink or so prior to the date, and the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. What was going on with these men as the meeting approached? They were building up what? Human emotions. They were afraid. They were selfish. They didn't know if the
meeting would stick to their script or what. They just didn't know how the meeting was going to go. And that uncertainty produced within them the buildup of emotions, and it was only through alcoholic consumption that they could overcome this pain that came into their lives as the result of not drinking. That said, here's to you. Okay. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. The classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We are all familiar with this type. They're always going on the wagon for keeps. They are over-remorseful and make many resolutions but never a decision. Now, when we see never a decision, page XXX, in the middle there, a decision is step three. We are going to learn when we get to chapter five that step three is both a decision and a beginning. That there is the type of man who is unwilling to admit he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There is the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is the manic depressive type who is perhaps the least understood by his friends, about whom a whole chapter could be written. Then there are the types entirely normal in every respect except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people. And I see a lot of that classification in this room. Many of you have come up to me and greeted me, and some of you haven't, some of you haven't had a chance, and that's okay. Greeting me doesn't, you know, give you a merit badge, but I can see by some of your faces that you've accomplished great things. I can see the intelligence in your face, and I can see from some of you that you've done things in this world that are the envy of others. But there's one thing you can't do if you're here. I'm going to assume you can't control the amount of M&Ms you eat once you've started, and you can't keep from eating M&Ms now that you want to on your own because of the buildup of everyday human emotions. And when these emotions build up within you, you will look for desperately a solution to the unrelenting, searing, unforgiving pain of not eating. And when we're not eating, we feel terrible. Remember people would say, you know, don't eat so much, you'll feel better? They were right. I felt anger better. I felt fear better. I felt like killing myself better. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. The phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy. There's that word, abnormal, adverse reaction, which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. What's he telling you there? Put down the food. And if you don't put down the food, you will not progress in this program. If you're anything like me, you've got to put down the food. That's the third time. This immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, the general opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. What is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. Now, the first of these is about Hank Parkhurst, and the second is about Fitz Mayo. Hank Parkhurst was very instrumental in the publishing of this book. He was the primary author of the chapter Two Employers, and Hank Parkhurst was a real sharp business guy. And in the first edition of the big book, he wrote a story called The Unbeliever. Most of this book was typed and written in his office in Newark, New Jersey. Anybody going to the Vision for You convention in September in Newark, New Jersey? I am. You are? I'll see you there. Okay, there's just going to be a couple of us. We're going to maybe take a trip to 17 Williams Street, which is where Hank Parkhurst's office was, which was where Ruth Hock typed this book. So we're going to take a little pilgrimage over there, and I hope maybe you'll come with us. Okay. About 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had been partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life, was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. This is about Fitzmaio now, very instrumental. When I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and, deciding his situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology, spiritual awakening, and we doubted if even that would have any effect. However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. He has not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then, and he is as fine a specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. William Silkworth, William D. Silkworth, MD. And again, I want to remind you that when you walk into a meeting, you are walking in here on the shoulders of giants. And William Silkworth is clearly one of those giants, as is Hank Parkhurst, as is Fitzmaio. I don't have the time to go into all that, but trust me, when you walk in here, you are on the shoulders of giants. And the depth that I accept Dr. Silkworth's opinion will determine the urgency that I will do the rest of the steps. Now, we're going to look at Bill's story, and perhaps if there's anything I want to do by coming here to Santa Barbara, if there's anything I would love to accomplish, it is to help you see Bill's story in a new way. It's in here because the book was meant at first to be a 12-step call in and of itself. Without the benefit of fellowship, it was, you know, it was supposed to be a self-contained kind of textbook, kind of instruction manual. Bill Wilson was born on November 26, 1895 in East Dorset, Vermont. East Dorset, Vermont is a little tiny place that backs up to another place called Manchester, Vermont, and Dorset, Vermont. Manchester, Vermont, which is going to come into play here in the second 8 pages of the book, is a place where rich people had summer homes and came to play, which is right where East Dorset is. And Bill was born to an alcoholic, Emily and Gilman Wilson. Gilman was his father, and he was an alcoholic. And he had a younger sister named Dorothy, who will also play into the equation here. Dorothy will later in her life marry Dr. Leonard Strong, and Dr. Leonard Strong will figure large in the history of AA and why we're here today. Bill Wilson was a thin, lanky boy, and in 1906, when he was 10 years old, not quite 11, his parents divorced because of his father's alcoholism, and his mother and father abandoned him really to the maternal grandparents, and Bill and Dorothy were raised by their maternal grandparents. And he was a tall kid. He always felt the stigma of the divorce. He had a very serious inferiority complex. He suffered from anxiety his entire life. He was bound and determined to work 5 times harder than anybody else to be half as good. He read in a book he read in a magazine that only an Aborigine could fashion and throw a boomerang that would actually come back to you. And he worked tirelessly. He cut into the headboard of his bed. And Grandpa Griffith was not happy with him. But he cut into the headboard of his bed, and he fashioned a boomerang that I have held in my hand because I went to his house in East Dorset, Vermont. And he made the boomerang actually come back, and when it did, it almost took Grandpa Griffith's head off in the cemetery. And he also found a violin up in Grandpa Griffith's attic, and he became so diligent at practicing violin that he became co-first chair of his grammar school's orchestra. He also found a baseball glove up there and worked tirelessly to become the starting shortstop and co-captain of his school's baseball team. Bill Wilson also suffered from depression, and depression would plague him throughout his life. When he was 17 years old, the love of his life was Bertha Bamford. This is before Lois. He was in love with Bertha Bamford, and Bertha went to New York from Vermont to get what was told to Bill as a very routine surgery. Very routine surgery. And she went and died. She died on the table. And when Bill found out about this, he fell into the first of his many, many deep, dark depressions, which, as I said, would plague him throughout his life. Let's go to page one in the big book, Bill's story. War fever ran high. Before we start, let me just again throw one other thing in here. Bill's grandfather was also an alcoholic, as was Bill's father. But Bill's grandfather, paternal grandfather, he got sober by going to Mount Elias, and he felt the wind blowing through him. He had a spiritual experience up there, never drank again. But it's also important to point out that Bill's story is divided into two distinct sections. The first 8 pages are Bill's plunge into the abyss of his alcoholism, and the second 8 pages is about how our recovery was affected therefrom by a spiritual experience, which we'll get into when we get to those pages. War fever ran high in the New England town to which we knew young officers from Plattsburgh. Plattsburgh is a city in upstate New York, and Plattsburgh was where the soldiers went to get training, and they were assigned there for boot camp, and then they would move on. We were flattered when the first citizens took us to their homes, making us feel heroic. Here was love, applause, warm, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. I fought the strong warnings and the prejudice of my people concerning drink. In time, we sail for over there. When he says over there, he is referring to World War I. World War I. I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. We landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved, I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot, whether he dieth by musket or by pot. Now let's amplify that just a little bit, because the effect that this is going to have on Bill is going to be profound. What is he looking at? He's looking at a tombstone of a soldier who did not die in battle, but died because he drank himself to death. When they talk about pot, musket is a gun, whether he dieth by musket or by pot. Pot referred to drinking beer. They drank beer in England in those days in quart pots or pint pots. And when they would drink, it was considered very ugly manners to sit and drink. They would stand and drink in the saloon. And a bar, which is where we get the name from, a bar was erected so that they could lean against the bar as they drank. And in the late 1600s and the early 1700s, they would say to the people in England, if they were getting a little rowdy, watch your pints and quarts over there. Watch your pints and quarts over there meant behave yourself or we're going to cut you off. And when that expression through trade came to the colonies, in the early 1700s, late 1600s, the colonialists shortened it to watch your P's and Q's, and that's where we get that into our language today. As watch your P's and Q's comes from an old drinking admonition of watch your pints and quarts. See, we give you everything here. We give you etymology, we give you a little Yiddish, we give you history, we'll give you a lot of stuff here. Ominous warning, which I failed to heed, page 1. 22, in a veteran of foreign wars, I went home at last. I fancied myself a leader, for had not the men of my battery given me a special token of appreciation, my talent for leadership, I imagine, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with the utmost assurance. Sorry. I took a night law course and obtained employment, page 2, as investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important. My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Now, this is evidence of Bill getting his dreams and his aspirations dominated by the alcoholism that surged through him. My eating disorder quashed every dream I ever dreamed. I could have done so much better with my life, I believe to this day. But it is what it is, and now it's in the books, and here I am. But I could have done so much better. I could have done so much better with my life than what I ended up doing and stuff. But my eating disorder just wouldn't hear of it. Now let's take a look at what it says here. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. We had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. What is he doing there? He's lying to Lois. What is the first victim of compulsive behavior? The truth. The first thing to go out the window when addiction is practiced is the truth. It is the first casualty of addiction, is any honesty whatsoever. Did you eat that? No. Are these M&M bags yours? No. Of course they're mine. What are you talking about? You gotta ask me the question? Come on. By the time I had completed the course, I knew the law was not for me. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that one day would turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. Now, in 2017, you might think $1,000 is just not a lot of money. I would be willing to bet that most of you, maybe not all of you, have a credit card or a debit card in your pocket right now that if you really, 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 really wanted something for $1,000, you could buy it, right? You may not want to. You may not want to spend that much money. But if you really wanted something, you could do it. $1,000 in those days was a lot of money. Just to put it in perspective for you, in Chicago in the 1920s, after World War I, you could buy a brand new house for about $1,800. You could buy a Ford motor vehicle, Ford Model A, for $495. So you could buy two new cars for $1,000. Just imagine that you have in your pocket the amount of money that it would take to buy two brand new cars, and that's that $1,000. Or, 80% of a house in your pocket? That's a lot of money, right? It went into certain securities, then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagined that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and managements, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. I had developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of markets. I discovered many more reasons later on. We gave up our positions and off we roared on a motorcycle, the sidecar stuffed with tent, blankets, a change of clothes, and three huge volumes of a financial reference service. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed, top of three. Perhaps they were right. I had had some success at speculation, so we had a little money, but we once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year. At the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there and the use of a large expense account. The exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for that year. He's making very good money now. Remember I told you Dr. Silkworth went to work at Towns Hospital in 1929 for $35 a week? Figure it out in your head. What did he make a year? And this guy's got a profit of several thousand dollars for the year. Now also, you might ask yourself, why did he do that? Well, in the 1920s, which was the biggest growth period that this country has ever had in its history, the stocks were surging and swelling to a point where you could literally take a chimp and put a chimp in a chair and say, throw a dart at the board, and if the chimp hit a stock, you could invest in that stock on about a 10% margin and you'd probably make money. And Bill looks at this. Now, Bill was not a stock broker. Bill was really a New York City stock speculator, and he knew that what goes up is going to eventually come down and we're gonna need more information. And the guys on Wall Street are scoffing at this, saying, oh, you're nuts. We're making money hand over fist. What the heck is wrong with you, Wilson? Go back and drink and get more drunk and just leave us alone. And he says, I'm going to show these guys. You know, Bill was cunning, baffling, and powerful, too, that we really do need this information. Why did Lois go along with it? Because she felt that if she would just give in to him, that maybe he would stop drinking. So she was looking for a geographic. And you can see pictures of them. Online, she's in the sidecar and she's all hunched over with her helmet on and her, you know, all this stuff. And he's driving the motorcycle, you know, he's driving the thing. The only reason she went along with that really was because she felt that if she did this, then he might stop drinking. You never know. Of course, we can see where that goes. Middle of three. For the next few years, fortune through money and applause my way. I had arrived. Here's the kid from East Dorset, Vermont. Never had anything in his life. He's on Wall Street. They're living on Park Avenue. They've got a beautiful apartment. He is doing extremely well. These guys are looking at him like he is unbelievable. Everything is coming up roses. My judgment and ideas were followed by many, not one or two, many, to the tune of paper millions. Now, could you just imagine what this would do for your ego? I don't care whether you're a housewife, I don't care whether you're a surgeon or someplace in the middle, I don't care. But what you do becomes the standard. How you do it becomes the standard. He's Bill Wilson, and people are looking at him, and they're investing millions of dollars, and he's taking some of these profits for himself because that's the deal he makes with these guys. He is a New York City stock speculator, and he makes his living selling his opinions to people. They invest on his opinion and cut him in on the profits. That's what he's doing for a living, and he is doing extremely well. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spent in thousands, chattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair weather friends. So people want to be close to him. He's the man. He is the man. He has got it going on. He's making money. He's showing them what his opinion is. They're going on his opinion. Everybody's making money. Happy days are here again. Let's see where we go from there. My drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances are protestations, of my friends terminated in a row, not a row, but a row. And I became a lone wolf. Wait a minute, what the hell? You mean to tell me that he chose liquor over these friends? Wait a minute, I thought he wanted friends. You mean to tell me he chose liquor over his success? I thought he wanted success. Well, what did I do? I was in bed with Sara Lee Brownies. I was in bed with M&Ms, the peanut kind, not the other kind. I was in bed with Oreo cookies. I wanted to be out with girls. I wanted to be out with the boys. I wanted to be the toast of the town. I wanted to be the guy out there. But I was home eating. And the whole time I was eating at home, I wanted to be not eating, but I didn't know how to bridge that gap between going for what I wanted and getting away from the food. Why? Because the food was doing something for me instantly that nothing else could do or would do. And I was so morbidly obese, I knew that I wasn't going to attract any women. I mean, how many 500-pound guys, you know, out there, you know, are getting the attention of women except to say, could you step away from me or something? But the bottom line is that, okay, there were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. There had been no real infidelity, for loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness, kept me out of those scrapes. Well, there's a book in AA called As Bill Sees It, and there's a book in Al-Anon called As Lois Remembers, and this is one part where they're not always the same. In 1929, I contracted golf fever. We went at once to the country with my wife to applaud while I started out to overtake Walter Hagen. Liquor caught up with me much faster than I came up behind Walter. I began to be jittery in the morning. Golf permitted drinking every day and every night. It was fun to carom around the exclusive course which had inspired such awe in me as a lad. I acquired the impeccable coat of tan one sees upon the well-to-do. The local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of his till with amused skepticism. Now, one of the things that Dr. Burnham had, Dr. Burnham was Lois's father, and Dr. Burnham was a doctor, as it says. Dr. Burnham had a home in the country in Manchester, Vermont, and he had other people that would lend Bill and Lois ways to go to the country. And when he would be drinking in the city, they would go to the country. When he'd drink in the country, they'd come to the city. So they would try various geographics. There should really be a sign on the where it says entering Arizona. There should be a sort of an annex. It's not going to work here either. Just keep on going either to California or New Mexico, but it's not going to work. You see a lot of people in Arizona trying geographic cures, and I saw a lot of that in Oregon too, and I assume you'd see a lot of that here in California too. Yeah. I would assume. Abruptly, in October 1929, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. I'm on page 4. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock. 5 hours after the market closed, the ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of tape which bore the inscription XYZ32. It had been 52 that morning. I was finished, and so were many friends. The papers reported men jumping to death from the towers of high finance. That disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. My friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock. So what? Tomorrow was another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. These guys were killing themselves, and Bill is looking down his nose at the people that are killing themselves. Make note of that, because we're going to be referring to that in a page or two here. We're going to be thinking about that as Bill's mind and Bill's life change, and he's going to sort of rethink that subject here in a little bit. But why were they killing themselves? Because everything that they believed in, everything that they knew, everything about their lives that they had worked for was destroyed in an instant. Now, you had a situation in this country not long ago in the mid-2000s where you had 10 and 15% unemployment, and you saw the absolute disgust of the people in the United States at that time. In the 1930s, you had 50 to 60% unemployment among whites. Among blacks, you had unemployment of 90 to 95%. Among other minorities, you had unemployment near 100%. So you have people in soup lines, you have people destitute, you have people that have no money, that have worked their entire lives, and they're making nothing. And the catastrophic conditions were so unbelievable that they didn't know what was going to happen. They absolutely didn't know what was going to happen. There was no help coming from any direction whatsoever. And as they would think that they're pulling out of it a little bit, they really weren't. And things would go up and down a little bit. But the Great Depression was a period of time in the 1930s that was also coupled with the starvation of the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma and the panhandle of Texas and so on, when they would uproot these grass crops to plant seeds, to plant bread, and the dust would just be everywhere. And you had the greatest health epidemic at that time was starvation. People were literally starving to death. In this country, in the United States of America, people were starving to death. There was no food, there was no money, there were no jobs, there was nothing. So you have to get a picture of what this is that we're dealing with here. You have, again, among whites, you have 50 to 60% unemployment. Among African Americans, you have 90 to 95% unemployment. And among some other minorities, you have anywhere between 90 and 100% unemployment, 99% unemployment. Certain ones of them could tenant farm or whatever, and it was just a deplorable situation, just an absolute deplorable situation. And nobody knew when it was going to end, and nobody knew if it was going to end. And when the United States gets a cold, the rest of the world got pneumonia. And so you have worldwide depression. And the worldwide depression just clamped its noose around everybody's neck. So this is, I don't have the time to go into the whole history of the depression, but this is the condition, these are the conditions which he is in So this is how he's living. Okay. Next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. That was his friend, Dick Johnson. He had plenty of money left and thought I had better go to Canada. By the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No St. Helena for me, but drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time, we stayed broke. Now, before we read the next paragraph, we have to remember that the Burnhams were Lois's mother and father. Dr. Burnham did not like Bill Wilson. That is the understatement of the year. A, Lois married a man who was not only a drunk, but was several years younger than her. And Dr. Burnham disapproved of Bill very strongly. Lois had an ectopic pregnancy. She actually had two of them, but she had an ectopic pregnancy. And she couldn't stop the bleeding. She calls Daddy. Daddy goes to the apartment. Daddy says, "We are going to the hospital, Lois." And they go to the hospital. And in the evening, around 7 p.m., they leave a note for Bill. "We are at the hospital. Please come immediately." 8, 9 o'clock the next morning, he's already pissed in his pants. He's already been vomiting. He hasn't brushed his teeth. He hasn't shaved. He hasn't bathed. He hasn't combed his hair. He's wearing the clothes that he got drunk in. He's wearing the clothes that he was on the floor of the bar with. He comes into the hospital 12, 13, 14 hours after Lois is admitted, and Dr. Burnham is beside himself. Here's this Prince of Wall Street, my son-in-law, the millionaire, the rich stock speculator, and here he is, he's pissed in his pants, and this is who my daughter Lois is married to. He's not exactly happy about the situation. They get Lois fixed up. Then the rest of what we just talked about happens. So when you read these words, "We went to live with my wife's parents," the reason I want to expand on the history of this is so you get a picture of the environment that he's in. It wasn't, "Oh, Tatala, I understand. We'll take you in. Oh, can I make you anything? Can I draw you a bath?" No, not at all. Here's this Wall Street big shot who threw it in Dr. Burnham's face. "Hey, look at me now, Doc. What do you think now? What do you think of Lois now?" Now, all of a sudden, he's on the other side of midnight. "We went to live with my wife's parents, bottom of four. I found a job." He goes home and tells Lois, "I got a job, Lo," tells Dr. Burnham, "I got a job." Whoop. Then lost it as a result with a brawl with a taxi driver. He's fist fighting with a taxi driver in front of the house on Central Park West. On Clinton Street. Central Park West is where Towns Hospital is. On Clinton Street, 182 Clinton Street, he's fist fighting with a cab driver. They get word of it and they fire him. "Mercifully, no one could guess I was to have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in a department store, Macy's, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. I became an unwelcome hang-around at brokerage places. Here's the guy with the fair weather friends. Here's the guy that's one of the toasts of Wall Street. Now they don't want him. Now he comes into the brokerage office and they tell him, Bill, you smell. Bill, you've got BO, you've got bad breath, you look terrible. Did you crap in your pants? Why don't you just go somewhere else? Why don't you just go somewhere else? And he became an unwelcome hanger-on. That's his alcoholism. And also, you have to remember what their domestic life was like. She says to him, Lois, not Mrs. Burnham, not... She says to him, Bill, I'm going to work now. So she's going to be on the subway. Then she's going to be standing. She has to go to Manhattan because they're in. She has to go to this department store. She's going to be on heels for 10, 15 hours a day. She makes $19 a week. He used to bring home plenty of money. With commission, she's making $26, $27 a week. She says to him, by the way, my darling husband, who I love more than life itself, could you please take a shower, shave, comb your hair, change your clothes, and would you take the breakfast dishes? You don't have to wash them. Don't wash them. Don't wash them. Take them from the table, put them in the sink. Can you handle that? Oh, yes, no problem. She'd come home that night. He stinks. No shave, no shower, no teeth being brushed. He's drunk on his ass now, and the dishes are still on the table. So could you just imagine what their domestic life is like? He's living with the Burnhams, who can't stand him. He's living with Lois, who's working in the department store. Now, you also have to remember, and I don't want to spend too much time on this because we're pushing the clock. This is the 1930s. Men worked, women didn't. Men were the providers. It's not the society you live in today. The egalitarian society that you live in today was non-existent at that time. Can you just imagine the shame he felt knowing that Lois was going to work and he couldn't provide for her, knowing where he had come from? And these are the emotions. This is the scenario that they're living in. And I spend time with it because I think it's important so we can really, really grasp it. Invite me back sometime and I'll do a whole retreat on the next sentence. Liquor ceased to be a luxury and became a necessity. Boy, does that sum up my life. Bathtub gin, because remember, this is also the days of prohibition. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day, often 3, got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s and I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens. This went on endlessly and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently because he was getting delirium tremens. I lived in Eugene, Oregon for 9 years. There is no OA there. There's no such thing. I had to go to AA and you'd see these guys and they look like a dog trying to crap out a peach pit. They're shaking like this. You talk about having a drinking problem. They're lucky if they took a cup of coffee and didn't throw it on the guy sitting behind them because they couldn't get it to their mouth. And some guy, mercifully, would kind of help them and put it to their mouth because these guys had the delirium tremens. Well, the heart is also a muscle. And when the heart gets affected by that, it's bon voyage. Nevertheless, oh wait, sorry, I skipped something here. A tumbler full of gin followed by half a dozen bottles of beer would be required. The key word here is required if I were to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation and there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. What's he doing there? He's going on a, starts with a D, ends in a T.
Diet.
Going on a diet, very good, front row black sweater. Going on a diet, and he went on a diet, and Lois sees, oh, he hasn't had a drink for 15 minutes, and she is just bouncing off the walls with happiness here. Gradually, things got worse. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died. My wife and father-in-law became ill. Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at a low point in 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and the chance vanished. This is a story within the story, and it takes place in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, a place I did a big book study in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. a number of years ago, and they took me for dinner in Cherry Hill, and I was like a kid in a candy store. I was breathing Bill's air. I was so happy. They took me for dinner at some place in Cherry Hill, and I was so excited. But anyway, these guys from Cherry Hill come to Bill, and they say, can you put together a deal for us? He says, sure. And they said, but if you're going to drink, forget it. We won't work with you. And he was on one of his diets, and he knew nothing about alcoholism. He just figured, well, as long as he's decided not to drink, and he hasn't had a drink for, you know, 15 minutes, that he was cured. So he says, oh, you don't have to worry about that. So they meet in a hotel in Cherry Hill, and a guy brings along a homemade jug of Jersey Lightning. And he passes around this jug of Jersey Lightning, and Bill lets it go by once. He lets it go by twice. And the third time that it came around, this guy says, hey, this is gluten-free. No. Hey, this is health. This is from the organic store or something. No, no. He says, I made this myself. It's Jersey Lightning. You can have one drink. Well, nobody in that room knew anything about alcoholism. So what caused Bill to take the first drink of that Jersey Lightning? The mental twist. What caused Bill to not come out of that room for 3 days and he was drunk? The physical allergy, because once he had a drink, it triggered the physical allergy. He drank because of the buildup of emotions, because in untreated sobriety, he was a dither with all these emotions. He was scared about the deal, and he was angry that he was in this situation, and he used to be a millionaire, and he used to live on Park Avenue, and he was successful, and he was a big shot, and now he's dealing with these peons, and these guys are talking about a deal that's going to net him a fraction of what he used to spend on God knows what. And he's PO'd. And he takes the drink of the Jersey Lightning, he triggers the allergy, and the chance vanished. Now he's got to go home and tell Lois that once again, the liquor has destroyed him. I woke up, this had to be stopped. I saw I could not take as much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. What's he going on again over here?
Diet.
Another diet, thank you. Thank you, another diet. Shortly afterward, he's on a diet. He came home sober. No, he came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way. I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, going back on my
diet.
Unbelievable. There you go. I tried again. Some time passed and confidence began to be replaced by cocksuredness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. And we've all been there. We've lost the weight. We got into the dress, we got into the suit, we got into the shirt, we got into the pants, and by the time we got home, we would never wear them again because they would never fit again. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. Now take a look at that. They didn't have a phone at the shoe store. They didn't have a phone at the automobile repair shop. They didn't have a phone at the barber shop. This guy has to go into a cafe to make a telephone because he was already rehearsing in his mind. But lo, I just went in there to make a call. He could have gone to the damn barber shop to make a call. I bet they had a phone in there. I walk into a cafe. In no time, I was beating on the bar asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then. And I did. And how many times is that my story? How many times? Oh, I blew the diet. I might as well eat chocolate-covered cherries. I blew the diet. I might as well eat a box of Oreo cookies. I blew the diet. You fill in the blank yourself, whatever it is you used to binge on. What caused Bill to take that first drink? The mental twist from the buildup of emotions. What caused Bill to beat on the bar and say, I'll manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk, and I did. What made that happen? The physical allergy, which made the craving beyond his control. The adverse, abnormal reaction to the food, beverage, or substance. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning were unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. In other words, I was in that position too. He knows he's going to die. He knows he can't stop. There is something inside of him that says, this is not going to end well. And that was my life too. I hardly dare cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it was scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My writhing nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? Now he's considering it. Remember we talked about make note of that thing with the suicide? Now he's thinking about killing himself. And I obsessed about suicide for a long time, too. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? No, not now. Then a mental fog settled down. Gin would fix that. So two bottles and oblivion. Now he's drinking for the same reason I was eating in the later years. I was eating for oblivion. I couldn't stand the pain of eating, and I couldn't stand the pain of not eating. The pain of life was just too much for me. I couldn't take it anymore. And the only thing I knew to do was to do the very thing that had caused my pain in the first place. I went back to the buzzsaw of M&Ms. I went back to the buzzsaw of God knows what. And I would eat and eat and eat and eat to try to kill the pain of all the food that I had eaten. I ate railroad cars full of Doritos to kill the pain of eating railroad cars full of Doritos. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms, for mine endured this agony two more years. When I read that sentence, I think back of being emasculated by the time I was around 9 or 10. I think back of having towels shoved between layers of flab. I think back of the physical pain. I think back of the loneliness that I felt. You know, most people can lose their weight in months or maybe a year. They can lose all their weight. I knew that it was going to be years before I resembled anything like normal. I lost 200 pounds in this program, and I was still a 500-pound man. I lost another 100 pounds, totaling 300, and I was a 400-pound man. I lost 400 pounds in this program, and I was still a 300-pound man. And I wondered often, why me? Why me? Like my father before me, how did I possibly survive it? I don't know. He cursed God for helping him survive. I bless God for helping me survive. But the bottom line is, there were hundreds of Saturday nights where I wished to God I could have held somebody's hand or been with somebody in a movie or anything. But there I was alone watching TV and just shutting myself off from any semblance of normality because of this illness. And there I was doing all the right things, and people were still making fun of me, people were still teasing me, people were still abusing me, people were still saying things to me that you wouldn't say to Hitler. Well, maybe him, but they would say things to me that you wouldn't say to your worst enemy. And I didn't know how to tell somebody when I was 400 or 500 pounds, but I'm doing everything the right way. I'm going to meetings every single day. There was never a day I didn't go to meetings. I went to meetings every day. I worked my fingers to the bone, but I still had an obese body. So to the world, I was screaming the illness, when inside, I was doing everything I could do. I just didn't feel that that was fair. So when he says the mind and body are marvelous mechanisms, for mine endured this agony two more years, I think back on my own life. I think back on my own life, and it is a miracle that I survived. I lost decades to this illness. I pissed away decades of my life to this disease. I went on my first date with a girl when I was 35 years old, but I will not give this illness one more second. Not another second. Many of the adults that I knew as a child came out of the camps. They came out of the concentration camps. My father did not. My father was older than them. But they would grab my face as a child with the numbers on their arms that the Nazis had tattooed on their arms. And they would say to me, live until you die. Live until you die means don't let them kill you. Don't let them continue to kill you. Live until you die. And I'll never forget that. There was a lady, one of our neighbors, she would always send us to the store, and we'd buy something for her for like $3, and she'd give us 10. And she'd say, go and do so you can come back. But and then she'd grab our faces and she'd say, live until you die. Live until you die. And I never forgot that. I think to myself sometimes when I want to give up, when I promised Roseanne at the end of her life, I went to see her. I was summoned. I thought it was a mafia hit. I was at the OA birthday. Somebody tapped me on the shoulder and says, "Roseanne wants you to come to the hospital." I figured, uh-oh, this is a hit. So I went there and she said, "Promise me that you will continue to travel and do what you're doing for as long as you can." I says, "Rosie, I'll do it. I'll do it." And I said to her that day in the hospital, she was suffering terribly. She died not long after that, maybe a year before the birthday. But I said, "Rosie, you'll live for 1,000 generations times 1,000 generations. You will never die. The sun will never set on what you did." Mm. And she liked that. Okay, enough. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms. For mine endured this agony 2 more years. Could you just imagine? Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling. There were flights from city to country and back as my wife and I sought escape. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture were so hellish, I feared I would burst through my window sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor lest I suddenly leap. A doctor came with a heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. This combination soon landed me on the rocks. People feared for my sanity. So did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking. I was 40 pounds underweight. Is his being 40 pounds underweight any less healthy than what we do? No. He can't eat. He's got alcoholic gastritis. It hurts him to eat. If there were no olives in the martinis, they forget it. He wouldn't consume food at all. Some of these guys in AA, now I lived there, you know, in Eugene for 9 years. They have a sense that every once in a while they should eat a bologna sandwich or something, but they don't eat. They don't. Their digestive systems are so torn up, they can't bear the thought of food. They can't even bear the thought of it. Now, we're going to start to see something very important, because in the shivering darkness of the cave of alcoholism, God is going to begin the miracle, the process. The constellations of recovery are starting to get enjoined now, and we're going to start to see God's hand in the things that are about to happen. Page 7, my brother-in-law is a physician. That's Dr. Leonard Strong. And who's he married to? Dorothy Wilson, Bill's younger sister. That's right. And that through the kindness of that of my mother. Now, Bill's mother went to Boston and became an osteopathic physician when she divorced his father. And his father went to Western Canada to work in lumber and granite and marble. But Bill's mother was an osteopathic physician in Boston. I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. What hospital is that? The Towns Hospital in New York City. And it says, under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill bodily, the allergy, and mentally, the twist of the mind. And who is he meeting? He's meeting Dr. William Duncan Silkworth. Of all the hospitals he could have ended up in, where nothing would have happened for us, he ends up at the Towns Hospital. And what doctor does he happen to get assigned to? He gets assigned to be under the direct care of Dr. William Duncan Silkworth, the medical director of the place. If he would have been assigned to another doctor, we might not be sitting here today. Is it odd or is it God? Is it odd or is it God? It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcohol... Now, this is when he goes into the hospital the first time. This is spring of 33. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself, now I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. When he says the goose hung high, goose is a symbol of prosperity. Goose is a symbol of success. When it says the goose hung high, that means he's doing well. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it was not. For the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This is April of 34. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain. Wet brain is really a dry brain. When they get drunk, it takes the moisture out of these cells, and the brain and the liver cannot rehydrate themselves. Other cells can, but the liver and the brain can't. And wet brain is really a pathetic situation for some of these alcoholics, well, anybody that has it. A wet brain is really a dry brain, but these guys, they become like vegetables. They're like zucchinis. They come in the morning and they change their diaper and they plop them in front of the TV set, or they feed them and they plop them in front of the TV, then they change their diaper, feed them again. Their families come and cry. No, they don't know anybody. They don't know anything. They have, at least Alzheimer's has the decency to kill you. At least Alzheimer's has the decency to take you out. But with wet brain syndrome, you could last like that for decades. But it was a wet brain that named us Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a wet brain that came out of an institution, and he came out long enough when they were debating what to call the book, and the book gave the name to the fellowship. And he was one. This guy had been one of the founders of Harper's Magazine. And he comes out of a fog, and he says, Anonymous Alcoholics, Alcoholics Anonymous. They were thinking of calling it The Way Out. They were thinking of calling it the Bill Wilson, the Bill W. Movement. They were thinking of calling it 100 Men. Then a woman came in, and you know, they couldn't call it 100 Men and a Woman. And and this guy, Anonymous Alcoholics, Alcoholics Anonymous. So you never know where God's going to give you the God shot. You just never know how, you know, how it's going to happen. Okay. I returned to the hospital and returned. Perhaps she would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. They did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. He wants to die, so did I. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities, of my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining that endless procession of sots who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I was overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. No better description of my life than this paragraph right there. I had met my match. Food was my master. Perfect description of the powerlessness, the insidious horror of this illness. It's a nightmare. It's a horror. This illness is a horror. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered me for a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of that first drink. And on Armistice Day is November 11th, 1934, I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty, not the possibility, but the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted in what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. These are beautiful promises here. You don't have to wait for page 83. The first dimension is height, then width, height, width, depth, and the fourth dimension is the dimension of the spiritual. Soon to be, I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen. With a certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that day. That night and the next day, my wife was at work. I wondered whether I dared hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight. Now, we're going to depart from the book here for just a minute because I got to tell you a story. And this is a very important story because this is the history of step two. If you're around me long enough, you're going to learn that I believe with all my soul that 2 and 10 are the most underutilized, 3 and 4 are the most misunderstood. 2 and 10 are the most underutilized, 3 and 4 are the most misunderstood. And this is the history of how step two came into the program. We've been talking about events in 1933 when Bill first goes into the hospital and 1934, but there are other things that are going on here. And this is, we're going to break for lunch here in about 15, 20 minutes. But there are other things going on here that Bill only knows little bits and pieces about. And these are very, very important parts of the entire story. Let's first go to Rhode Island in our minds. And in Rhode Island is a very, very wealthy family. They own Burlington Mills, and they also own major amounts of stock in a company called Allied Chemical, which is still traded today. And Burlington Mills, if you've ever walked on carpeting in your life, you probably walked on Burlington Carpeting, and they owned it, and they were the Hazard family. And the Hazard family had a wayward son who was very, very alcoholic named Roland Hazard. Roland Hazard was a real bottom-of-the-barrel alcoholic. And he had plenty of money, but he had plenty of alcoholism too. And he once had himself sequestered on a Caribbean island, and he informed the quartermaster not to bring him any liquor. And for the year that he was confined to this Caribbean island, he managed to stay sober. He gets off the island in a very short period of time. Obviously, he's drunk. He's an alcoholic. That's what we do. That's what alcoholics do. I'm not an alcoholic, but that's what they do. He is now to a point, Roland, where he would like to give his mother the ability to see him sober just one more time before alcohol takes him out. And in the 1930s, just as it would happen, there is something else that's in its real infancy at that time, and that is the art of psychiatry. See, we think psychiatry has been around forever. It has not really been as it is now. It really was kind of coming into its own at this time. And Roland, where money is no object, obviously, he seeks out the services of the most preeminent psychiatrist in the world, whose name was Sigmund Freud. And Sigmund Freud wasn't taking on any new patients. So he asks Freud, "Freud, who's your number one protege?" And Dr. Freud says, "Adler, go to Adler. Adler will take you. He's my number one guy." So Roland goes over to Adler, and Adler says, "Sorry, we're all full up over here." And so he says, "Well, who's your number one guy after you and Freud?" He says, "The next guy lives in Switzerland, and his name is Dr. Carl Jung." And Dr. Carl Jung in Switzerland treated Roland for about a year, and Roland managed to stay sober. Of course, there wasn't any alcohol around, but he managed to stay sober. And Roland leaves the care of Dr. Jung after a year, and he goes to Paris, France. And from Paris, he's going to catch the ship back to New York, back to the United States. Who does he run into in Paris after having been treated by Dr. Jung? Is it odd or is it God? But he got to Jung, we'll find out in a minute. And he meets people in Paris who are very, very dear friends of his parents, who are there on a vacation, and they listen to Roland tell them about what he's been doing, what is he up to with Dr. Jung, and they say, "Let's toast, I'll get the finest bottle of bubbly." So they bust out the bubbly to celebrate Roland's sobriety, and of course Roland can't get on the ship, Roland can't even stand up, Roland can't walk, he's so drunk. He goes back to Dr. Jung, and Dr. Jung tells him, "Roland, I have misdiagnosed you." He could have told him, "You know, you better pay me more money," because he knew Roland had it. "I think you have a very serious belladonna deficiency or a valium deficiency, so you need to stay with me and I'll suck more money out of your wallet." He was too good of a mind to do that. He said to Roland, "You are going to die. I have misdiagnosed you. You are an alcoholic." And Roland, he grabs Dr. Jung, he says, "Come on, doctor, give me something to hang on to. I want to show my parents that I'm sober. I want to live." And Dr. Jung broke ranks with Adler and broke ranks with Freud in only one area. See, Freud and Adler believed that all solutions lie within the mind. But Jung broke rank with them and said, here and there are phenomena called spiritual experiences. He doesn't use the word spiritual awakening. Experience means sudden and profound. I didn't have that. I had a spiritual awakening, and the wording of step 12 was changed. Now we always say the first 164 pages were never changed. That's not true. They changed step 12. They said from spiritual experience to spiritual awakening. We'll get into that this afternoon. But anyway, Roland is looking for a spiritual experience, but he doesn't want to go into a traditional religion to find it. And in its infancy at that time also was something else, the Oxford Group Movement. And the Oxford Group Movement was founded by a Pennsylvania Lutheran minister named Frank Buchman. Frank Buchman was a minister who believed that Christians, after he moved to England near Oxford University, which is where this organization is going to get its name, he believed that Christians had lost their zeal, their enthusiasm for their Christianity. Now there's a good word, enthusiasm. It comes from two Greek words, enthekos, from God. Enthusiasm from God, enthekos, from God. Isn't that good? Okay. So he goes to China on a mission. This is Buchman, not Roland. Buchman goes to China on a mission, and he sees Christians in China who have rekindled this enthusiasm for Christ. They have rekindled this enthusiasm, how? Through altruism, through service to other people. And in service to other people, they have rekindled their enthusiasm for their Christianity. He goes back to New York City in the United States, and he meets with Sam Shoemaker. Sam Shoemaker is an Episcopalian minister, and he runs the Cavalry Mission in New York City. And Sam Shoemaker shares these views with Buchman, and Buchman shares views with Shoemaker, even though they're two different religions. And the Cavalry Mission in New York City becomes a hotbed for the fledgling Oxford Group movement. And Sam Shoemaker is in New York, and here comes Roland Hazard. Is it odd or is it God that all these things had to happen before Roland got there, or there wouldn't be an Oxford Group movement for him to go to? He comes into the Oxford Group movement, and he meets some guy named Seber Graves Jr., and Seber Graves Jr. is also an alcoholic, and he is staying sober, working the six-step Oxford Group Movement program. And Sebra and Roland and a guy named Shep Cornell, those are two names you don't hear. Sebra and Shep, you don't hear kids name that anymore. But anyway, and they're staying sober. Now, let's leave Roland in New York City at the Cavalry Mission for just a minute, and let's go up to Manchester, Vermont. Manchester, Vermont is right next door to East Dorset, Vermont. And who was born in East Dorset, Vermont?
Bill
Wilson, you are right on, right there, right in front of you. Excellent. You're my teacher's pet. Okay. Now, there's a guy who lived his life in Albany, New York, but they had a summer home in Manchester, Vermont. And his name was Edwin Ebbie Thatcher. And Edwin Ebbie Thatcher did a lot of drinking. He was an alcoholic, and he was in Albany, where his father had been the mayor, and his brother was to become the mayor after all these things happened as well. And Thatcher was embarrassing his family, and they said, get the hell out of here and go to the summer home in Manchester. This is summer of 34, spring and summer of 34. Get the house ready for us, and we'll be out as soon as we can. So Ebbie goes out to Manchester, Vermont, which is right next door to East Dorset, where who is born?
Bill
Wilson. Very good. Okay. Now, Edwin Ebbie Thatcher is painting a wall outside the house. The wall's painting, and a pigeon lands on his wall. So he does what any normal person would do. He goes into the house. By now, the pigeon's long gone. He comes out with a shotgun, and he starts blasting the wall. So, of course, he's drunk, and the neighbors call the police. This is summer of 34, and the neighbors call the police, and Ebbie is brought in, and he is put on probation. And they say, if you do this again, you're going to Brattleboro. Now, what is Brattleboro? Brattleboro is a city in Vermont, but it is also the home of the state insane asylum, which is what they did with drunks in those days. They would put you in the insane asylum. So they say to Ebbie, if this happens again, Ebbie, we're going to have to bring you to Brattleboro. And Ebbie didn't want any part of Brattleboro. A couple months pass. This is now August of 34. Ebbie is drunk. He drives right into a woman's kitchen without the slightest bit of contrition, without the slightest bit of remorse. He doesn't say, I'm sorry. He doesn't say, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I had this and that, and let me pay for this. He says to the woman in a drunken rage, hey, Toots, how about a cup of coffee? So she calls the police. The police come.
This is now late August of 1934, early September of 1934. Ebbie is in the lockup at the East Dorset, Vermont jail, awaiting trial, awaiting sentencing to Brattleboro Insane Asylum. Now, let's go back to Roland. Gee, I thought I forgot about Roland. I didn't. Roland and Seabrook Ray Jr. go visit the Hazards in Rhode Island. And they're quelling. If you don't know what Jews help the non-Jews, quelling is rapture beyond belief. Your daughter is becoming the president of the United States. You're quelling. Whatever. So, they're going crazy. They're overcome with joy. They're overcome with emotion, seeing their little boy sober. And they say to Roland, you need a vacation. You've been working your tush off at that Oxford group thing. You need a vacation. Go anywhere you want. We'll pay for it. So Seabrook and Roland decide to take a trip to where Seabrook Graves Jr. lives to meet their family, his family. And Seabrook Graves Jr. just happens to be from a city called East Dorset, Vermont. And they go to East Dorset, Vermont in early September of 1934. And they hear about their old buddy, their old drinking acquaintance, Ebbie Thatcher. And Ebbie is going before the judge, and Roland and Seabrook Graves Jr. go to the judge to petition the judge to release Ebbie to their care, and they will take him to the Oxford group in New York to see if they can get him sober. The judge's name just happens to be Seabrook Graves Sr. Is it on or is it gone? And in September of 1934, Roland Hazard and Seabrook Graves Jr. are in the judge's chamber with Ebbie. Ebbie is signing extradition papers which say this, essentially. If I don't do what these men say, I will be remanded, I will be extradited back to Vermont, and I will be put in Brattleboro Insane Asylum, no ifs, ands, or buts. Ebbie goes into the Oxford Group movement in September of 1934, and from September to October is 1 month, and from October to November is 2 months. He has 2 months of sobriety, and Ebbie is tapped on the shoulder, and they say to him, you must go give testimony. And he says, what do you mean? Go tell someone else what God did for you. And he goes, I don't want to go give testimony. And they say, that's all right. We'll just send you back to the insane asylum. And he says, you know what? I think I'll go give testimony. Sounds good. And you can tell I raised a daughter. Think, like Winnie the Pooh, think, okay. He's thinking, who the heck can he go give testimony to this thing without embarrassing the daylights out of himself? And Ebbie Thatcher thinks about his old drinking buddy. And he thinks about his old friend from East Dorset, Vermont. They did lots of drinking together. Ebbie used to say, if I ever get to be as bad and drunk as Bill Wilson, I'm going to quit. And Bill used to say, if I ever get to be as bad and drunk as Ebbie Thatcher, I'm going to quit. And he calls on his friend Bill Wilson in November of 1934. We're going to break for lunch, and we're going to see what happens as the result of that meeting between Ebbie and Bill.